A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on October 19, 1986, in the series No Stained Glass Saints, entitled Moses, Short-Fused Freedom Fighter with a Song. The scripture readings are Exodus 2, verses 11 through 15, chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, and chapter 4, verses 10 through 17, and Hebrews 11, verses 23 through 29. The texts for the sermon are Exodus 4, verse 13, and Hebrews 11, verse 27. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
The New Testament lesson says that everything we just read about in the Old Testament lesson, Moses accomplished by faith. Hebrews 11 is the great chapter on faith, and the point is that what Moses was able to do, he did through faith, which I suppose means that all the great things he accomplished not because he was naturally endowed with great gifts, although he was. He did it by faith. That means all that he accomplished not because he had tremendous training and education, although he had that. He did it by faith. I suppose that means that it wasn't through a set of accidents of history or training or natural endowments or anything else, but rather that God's hand was on that man and that he accomplished great things, shaping human history because of the call and the claim and the enabling of God, and not because he was Moses. Not because of anything that was peculiar to him as a person, but because as a person he was claimed by God. Now, this series of messages is not an attempt to debunk the great heroes of the Bible, but it is an attempt to say that the great God has done extraordinary things through ordinary people rather than the other way around. We've tipped the biblical story on its head in the traditional way we've handled these stories in the church, in preaching, I'm afraid as well in church school. We have painted saints in stained glass. We have lifted them high on a pedestal. We have whitewashed their characters. We have downplayed their flaws and their sins. We have made them someone to emulate. And then, either directly or by implication, we have said, if only you could be as good and as strong and as faithful and as steadfast as Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and David and Peter and Paul, then maybe God could do something with you too. But because you are only an ordinary mortal, with clay feet, with a bit of a flare and a great big flaw, therefore, don't expect God to be able to do anything with the likes of you. Well, that enables us simply to resign from the kingdom project and to wait for God to do it with somebody else. We will often do, even when we might be inclined to think that God was calling us to some task, we are likely to respond as did Moses. Who am I? I can't speak. I'm not eloquent. Who am I? Oh Lord, send somebody else. Send anybody else. Oh Lord, not me. Because I'm just an ordinary person. Well, the point of this series of messages is to say that that's all God ever has to work with, are ordinary persons. And the story of the Bible is not what a few great spiritual giants accomplished in the effecting of God's kingdom, but what the great God can do with any lump of clay, whatever the endowments or the training or the experience or the history, any lump of clay that becomes malleable in his hand. Persons like you, why, if the locus of God's revealing activity in human history were in the 20th century rather than in the 12th BC or the 1st AD, there might even here this morning be a Moses, an Abraham, an Isaac, a Peter, or a Paul. Because it's folks like you, through folks like you, that God can do what He has to do. In fact, until we learn that it's only in our brokenness and our humility that we can become the instruments of God's gift, we'll have the focus all wrong. Greatness certainly exists in human personality. And I am not saying this morning that there are no heroic figures in the course of the human drama. On Wednesday nights in the course Civilization, the telecourse that some of us are studying together, the history of Western civilization, Sir Kenneth Clark, the British historian who narrates the story, is one who believes that that history moves on the shoulders of a few great individuals, and that you could tell the story of a few great personages and you would pretty much have the story of civilization. And I think there is a good case that can be made for that. Moses is such an individual. Moses is one of the truly great spirits of all time. Moses is responsible for the founding of a nation, for the shaping of history, for the fathering of that nation in its birth in the Exodus, that nation whose civilization and culture and religion are still with us. Moses was a giant of a man. He had heroic qualities. But the point of this message is that it wasn't his natural endowment or his training or his history that enabled him to accomplish what he accomplished. He became the instrument in God's hand when all of his weaknesses and all of his flaws came to full blossom, and in humility he cast himself as an instrument on the mercy of God. Recently in the newspaper, there was an article by Sidney Harris. The title of it, "There's Evil Hidden Away in Greatness." One day I came to my desk and it was lying there. My desk at home. That means that Nancy cut it out. I'm not sure because she felt that there was evil or greatness. She probably felt there was a little of both. Every once in a while, cartoons or articles appear. Well, this time, in the providence of God, Sidney Harris had listened to our sermons, and he wrote accordingly, "There's evil hidden away in greatness." He wrote, "Sometimes we say half-jokingly that we don't want to go to heaven because all our interesting friends will be in hell." The thought has occurred to me. There is a dark, deep, existential truth hidden in this flippant remark. It implies a recognition that goodness alone often lacks vitality and spirit. One of the biggest mistakes that moralists and philosophers make, is assuming that good and evil are opposites, with goodness as positive, while evil is only a negative, an absence, a privation. It strikes me that this is a gross misreading of human nature. Mankind, as we know, has both good and evil impulses, and the one is as necessary as the other. In fact, as Martin Buber has put it, he who harbors an evil inclination has a great advantage, for he can serve God with it. The people we tend to call virtuous, or who think of themselves as such, tend to be bland and passive, self-protective, and interested only in their salvation. They are also usually quite dull. Usually, almost always. But the real leaders, even and especially among the saints, are personalities with strong drives and appetites who have learned to employ their evil in the service of their virtues. Their basic energy, however, is powered by their aggressiveness. Most virtuous folk simply repress or camouflage their bad impulses. They are so fearful of them that they rarely learn to enlist them in the service of goodness. This is why Santayana said, "It is easier to make a saint out of a libertine than out of a prig." The evil urge is even more necessary than its companion, as Buber points out, for without it, no man would woo a woman, beget children, build a house, or engage in economic activity. And we are told in Ecclesiastes that all travail and skill and work is the rivalry of man with his neighbor. This urge to prevail and expand is called the yeast in the dough. In a bad person, this urge runs wild to the destruction of others and often himself. But when the evil impulse is suffocated and not harnessed to the other, we have a goody-goody people who make passivity for virtue, who take passivity for virtue. Goody-goody people who may mistake passivity for virtue. Definition of the church. It is always the leader of the gang who is the brightest, the boldest, the most capable and imaginative, and it is only when this evil urge is used by the full personality that we get a Moses, a Luther, or a Gandhi. And then, to show that he had been listening into these sermons, he says, "You won't hear this in Sunday school." Of course you won't hear this in Sunday school. We wouldn't dare admit that in Sunday school. We don't dare admit the truth of the Scriptures because we have turned religion into a moral system whereby we can domesticate and socialize and control and manage the human race. What is church good for if it's not to make decent, law-abiding, obedient, subservient, passive, bland, dull citizens? Moses was not such. Moses had a streak of greatness in him. He was born in a time when the Hebrew children were being exposed by the rule of the Pharaoh. He was spared miraculously through an obvious act of the providence of God, maybe a parallel to Sarah's barrenness. Sarah, the mother of the nation, the couple from whom God would found a nation, were barren. Rebekah was barren. The gift of Isaac was the gift of God. And the gift of Joseph was the gift of God. And here the leader of the nation, the one who will bring Israel to freedom and found that people, is a male child that should never have lived, but miraculously is spared. Once again, God saying, "I'll do it my way. And it will be obvious when I do it that I have done it." Well, Moses, trained in all the learning of Egypt, educated, civilized, cultured, with a destiny to rule in that nation, learns of his own Hebrew roots, identifies with his own people, goes to survey the situation, sees their terrible abuse, sees this terrible exploitation of the human person. Something within him, some sense of justice or rightness, something within him simply burst forth, and he rose up. And he killed the Egyptian. In a moment of rash indignation, he becomes a murderer and a killer. St. Augustine said Moses was wrong to do that. Alexander White, the great Scottish preacher, says, Well, St. Augustine, I'm not so sure he was wrong to do that. But whatever he did, Moses did it knowingly and consciously, even though it indicated that he was one through whom the blood could rush and cause him to act impetuously. He had a short fuse, Moses did. But when he saw an injustice, he flailed out against it. He was conscious enough to look to the right and to the left to see whether or not anybody had seen him. So I suppose he wouldn't have gotten off on a claim of temporary insanity. But he was discovered. See, he had this good thing in him. He wanted to make things right with his people. He went out the next day. Thought he'd pulled it off. Thought he'd move again. Thought he could reconcile his brothers. But nobody likes a leader. So the offending party says, "Who made you a judge over us? You're going to kill me like you killed the man yesterday." And boom, he knew he had to get out of there. And he fled to Midian. No wonder, no doubt, replaying that whole thing in his mind. He comes to Midian and he comes to a well. And some women come up with a flock. And some bully boys come and drive the women off. And Moses drives the bully balls off because Moses is a guy that can't just sit there and watch it happen. Short fuse. A lot of power, a lot of energy, ready to bust forth. No dull and boring person this. But 40 years in the wilderness. 40 years of just tending the sheep. All of this training, all of this potential, all of this power pent up, being beaten in the furnace of God's affliction, until one day he has the encounter with a burning bush, hears the call of God, and at this time is sufficiently self-doubting to say, "Who, me? I can't speak." God said, "I don't want you to speak. I want to speak. I just need a tongue. I have no power." God said, "I'll be with you." "I have no authority." God says, "I'll go with you." Can't you get the point? You brew it when you try to do it on your own. What I want you to do isn't something that any human being can do. What I want you to do is something that I am doing. "Now will you get on with it, Moses?" He said, "Oh Lord, send somebody else." God said, "I am sending you. And if I have to, I'll give you Aaron, your brother. And I'll be with his mouth and you'll be like God to him. You give him the word and let him speak it if you can." Incidentally, Aaron spoke the first time and we never hear him speaking after that. Moses, struggling with his history, with his past, wrote himself off because, after all, hadn't he fallen? Hadn't he stained his robe badly? Hadn't he revealed the flaw of his nature? And even after 40 years in the wilderness, still not sure that there was something there that he could control. In fact, after the long experience of leading the cantankerous children of Israel, as they were making their way to the promised land, once again they ran out of water and they complained and they murmured, which was par for the course. And God said to Moses, "Speak to the rock." And if you read, I think it's the 20th or the 16th chapter of the book of Numbers, you'll find it. Moses was, he was so angry. He was so frustrated. He had had it up to here, the stained glass saint. And so God said, "Speak to the rock." And what did Moses do? He took his rod and he clobbered the rock. He said, "There, you rebels." And I suppose if it wasn't in the Bible, he might have even used another choice word or two. Oh, he was tired of that people. Sick and tired of it. And God said, "Nice going, Moses." Pretty hard finally to get all that under control, isn't it? And incidentally, you won't be going into the promised land. I'll show it to you from afar. Moses had to lead that people right up to the the edge of Jordan, knowing he wasn't going to go in. Because it's not God's purpose for us to flaunt our flaws or glorify our weakness. But the closing scene of his life is very intimate in converse with God. God puts him to bed, as it were. "Look it all over, Moses. You've really done a great job, and now, come home." At one point, his brother and sister challenged his leadership, and the Bible tells us that Moses was the meekest man on the face of the earth. Now, he didn't start out meek. If you start out meek, you're probably just weak. Meekness is not something to begin with. Fire and vim and vinegar is something to begin with. And then God has a way of honing that, refining that, so that Moses, whose wrath caused him to rise up and kill a man, could be described as the meekest man on the face of the earth. Finally. Broken, but lifted up. No stained glass saint, but a great leader with clay feet and a short fuse. But at his best, he led Israel in singing the doxology. He did love the Lord, and he did love those people. And he did have a vision that drove him on. And he sang and led Israel in song. "The Lord has triumphed gloriously. He is my God. I will exalt him. He is my God. I will praise his name." Oh, Moses. Short fuse. Hot head. Quick tempered. Easily provoked to wrath, humble, meek, broken, and gloriously used of a great God. Thanks be to God.